Welcome. Today we're going to deal with a number of issues, and the first one we'll attempt to go according to schedule and open up public hearing on Senate Bill 171. Colleagues, we heard this bill a while back exempting certain cogeneration facilities and small power production facilities from regulation. This bill, as I mentioned at the time, was going to be held for a while, frankly, because of the relating clause, so that we could deal with some of these issues regarding taxation of public utilities and the discussions that we have had both in revenue and business committee. And so today you have before you a dash 4 amendment, which is designed to follow recommendations from the Public Utility Commission, and we had also today in Senate Revenue. I think what I'll do first is ask that Commissioner Lee Beyer, and Lee, if you would like to come forward, and give this committee a synopsis of the recommendations by the Public Utility Commission in terms of how we deal with taxation. After we have this dialogue with Commissioner Beyer, I'll have Mr. Warner from Legislative Revenue then articulate the key elements of the Dash 4 amendments. So welcome, Commissioner Beyer. And I know you're not feeling great today, so we all understand how that feels. Senator Walker is in the same boat, and most of us have been there.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. A little uncomfortable being up here with all of the arrows in the back of the room, but that's okay.
We'll watch your backside.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how much detail you want me to go into. I did distribute yesterday copies of this packet to all of the all the members that are here, as well as the those of you who are also on revenue. So I think everybody's had a chance to do it, and I guess I'd start just by saying, after a fairly large discussion, review of legal issues and so forth, the Commission is forwarding to you three recommendations. Those are: one, that the legislature require regulated utilities to file standalone or deconsolidated income tax returns for Oregon taxation, and distinguish that from the federal returns, which, it's my understanding, you have no control over. Secondly, that you direct the commission to consider consolidated.
Are you going section by section?
Senator Montesano, he's going over his recommendations, and then Mr. Warner will explain the amendments.
Excellent.
Okay. Secondly, that with respect to consolidated benefits for federal returns, that you direct the commission to take those into consideration in rate making. And third, that you direct that regulated utilities file a general rate case at least once every 5 years. So those are basically the three recommendations that we put forth. As I told the Revenue Committee this morning, you have a fairly extensive record that I provided to you, probably about $20,000 plus of legal opinion from various counsel on that. So I think you have a pretty good background to help totally confuse you on the issue. This is a fairly complicated matter. I will say that, as I said this morning, this is an issue that I think is in front of you and was in front of the commission largely because of people's perceptions, primarily in the Enron ownership of PGE, that they were paying rates that included expenses for taxes, and in effect those taxes never flowed through to the Oregon Treasury or federal government or Multnomah County or anybody else. I think that's the issue. It's a perception of fairness. These recommendations are an attempt to recognize that. They are a significant departure from the current practice of the Public Utility Commission, which is to treat taxation as we set rates on a standalone basis. That means we just look at the regulated utility and not who owns them or other affiliates, and treat it like it existed on its own when we set a rate. Again, as I said this morning, that is a practice that is not without reasonableness. That's something that is done in most every other state in the United States and has been done for many, many years. There's only a small handful of states that have departed. Having said that, the reality is that many of your constituents feel that process is unfair. As we've looked through it, we have brought back to you recommendations which we think address that. We think they address the points and the requests that this committee and the Revenue Committee ask us to. There will be parties from both sides who I assure you will disagree with that. I believe you'll hear from the utilities that they think that the current system is the appropriate one and the one we ought to go. And I believe you will hear from consumer advocates that we probably don't go far enough. I should also say one of the issues discussed in our white paper, when we talked about that some weeks ago now, was the potential for an annual true-up of taxes, an actual true-up. We are recommending that you not do that, and the reasons basically are, one is, it, in a practical matter, we can't do it. We don't think we can accomplish that. Secondly, there are significant negative tax impacts with the federal code that make it not a good thing to do. And with that, I'm not going to go into great details, and I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you, Commissioner Beyer. We will open it up to questions. Colleagues, and as we have talked about this issue over the last couple of months, I see it primarily as one major focus, and that is with the regulated utility, that they are given the opportunity to collect what they believe is a tax liability, which during the rate hearing, the rate process, rate setting process, have an opportunity to make a case of what they feel their liabilities would be so that those can be collected by their ratepayers. So there is an expectation that that is a real liability. And to the extent that, especially when we find consolidated tax returns from activities that are unrelated to the services that those ratepayers are actually receiving and offsetting those costs, I mean, that's where the issue of fairness really comes in. And I appreciate, Commissioner, I know for a couple of years you've been working on trying to analyze a very, very complicated issue. And I appreciate the efforts of the Commission and your unanimous recommendation that you present to us today, and appreciate the very hard work on that. Question from the committee from Commissioner Beyer. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Commissioner, help me understand. We're fixing, you said in your remarks that we have a perception problem. We're fixing a perception problem. And it's largely revolving around Enron. So that was the target. But Enron is no longer a company. And so who is this directed at now to fix that perception problem? Who's going to be affected by this change?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, the issue arose around Enron, but I think it goes farther than that in people's minds. The reality is that basically when we set rates, we assume after we figure out what the expenses and acceptable return will be, we basically assume that the utilities, all utilities, in their rates will pay taxes. The reality is that it's unlikely that they ever pay the amount, fully the amount of taxes that we have included in our rates. Because of, as I said this morning, and largely that's the result of we don't know the policies that you and Congress set in terms of particular tax incentives that you provide them to do things that you perceive as a good public good. For example, accelerated depreciation. You're encouraging companies, the Congress is encouraging companies in general to spend on capital goods up front. The effect of that is that you're allowing them to reduce their otherwise taxable benefit from a straight line benefit. So that would be a departure. So that's an example. Pollution control credits, for example, that would be something that this body has encouraged Oregon companies to invest in pollution, advanced pollution control equipment. That's an offset through a credit against taxes that we would not have considered generally in the tax process. So that would be a departure from that. That's the job you're in, is trying to decide what incentives make sense, but you have a difference from what we may put into rates and what the public perceives as fair from other policies that you have set.
Go ahead. So without the Dash 4 amendments, we're going to have political campaigns that says PG only pays $10.
I don't know what political campaigns you're going to have.
Is that still possible without the Dash Force?
I assume that's possible without the Dash Force.
What happens under the Dash Force, the PGE?
I think you... I don't know how to speculate on that, Senator, because I don't know what their taxes may be in a future year. If they don't have a taxable liability for whatever reasons, you still may only have $10.
I'm sorry. I apologize for not talking in advance. I was running. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I hope you had your pedometer on.
No, I didn't. I think that thing is broken and doesn't work right, and taking it back, I ride bicycles and not run, so it's discriminatory.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many utilities in Oregon would be subject to these Dash 4 amendments?
To be honest, I haven't looked at the Dash 4 amendments. I just got them a few minutes ago.
Well, my understanding...
The earlier provision, the language that was in there, the citation, RS 314.60, if you use that one, which Mr. Warner and I talked about this morning, that is I believe that's out of the revenue section of the ORS, and that's a fairly broad description of what a public utility is, and I, one of the things I advised this morning is you may want to change that, and that's a decision you would make. The public utility definitions of public utility are in 757.005 for electric, gas, and water companies, and 759.005 for telecommunications. And 757, you're probably talking about three electric companies, three gas companies, and...
20, potentially 20 or so water companies,
private water companies. The telecommunications is broader. There's probably... between 4 and 20.
Yeah. Senator Starr, you brought up a very good point. In fact, Mr. Warner, you may want to add some more light to that. I think that is an error in the Dash 4 is how that's defined. I think it should be the 757 statute.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, Mr. Chair. The 314.610 is broad. It includes communication, transportation, furnishing of electricity, water, steam, oil products, or gas. So it's a fairly broad definition. There are more narrow definitions. There's also an alternative one also within the income tax statutes that's a little bit more narrow that the committee may want to look at.
I think the intent was the 757 statute that Commissioner Beyer, that would be one we would discuss further with the legislative council. I think that was an error.
The goal was to encompass the smaller number of
the energy companies, energy companies,
and the same ones that you just mentioned, the three electric, three gas, 4 to 20,
water.
Mm-hmm. So I guess then, if that's the target audience, and let's say the amendments are wrong, what additional workload going to put on the PUC? This isn't quite a bit of an additional scope in what the PUC has historically done, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, different pieces of it. The deconsolidation doesn't have a direct effect on our workload at all. That respects or relates to where the companies pay their taxes. The second piece regarding deconsolidation, it's just a different methodology that we would use in rate setting. I don't think it increases the workload in doing that. There's been some question raised about the requiring the 1 to 5 years in our recommendation rate case. Most of the energy companies are already coming in that kind of a timeline, so I don't think it really affects that at all. It's just different way to do business.
Okay.
Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With having Paul here and Lee, I think we have the right people here to the...
Can
the
I
heart
under the table?
You can bring you. I forget his name. We had him up this morning. But to me, the heart of this question is what type of animal is this? This, you know, on the tax status question of deconsolidated versus consolidated, you have the pure traded sector, Columbia Sportswear, or some firm like that, that we know has customers throughout the world and can easily make the case for a deconsolidated tax return. And so these amendments get at, and I don't know how you get it down to, what is that? Is that utility the same animal as a traded sector firm? Obviously, has a confined customer base, has a confined income stream that's regulated monopoly by the PUC. And so my interest would be in the Dash Force, can you get at really that group of different ligers, different type of animals for Senator Atkinson and my favorite new animal? Can you get at that new animal that and define it into statute? And that would be the test on the Dash Force is can you really do that? And then in the telecommunications industry is a, I don't know if they're in here, there they are, Quest and Verizon, do they meet that same definition? And then obviously we would be compelled to hear them out of why they wouldn't fit that same criteria that we would be setting out for PacifiCorp or for PGE.
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, I think you're hitting at the questions we were talking about this morning. I'm being real cautious here and say we're coming at you in response to the utility question. I think there are some legitimate legal questions that are outside of our ballpark, if you will, that relate to the tax equity and the definition. And I think those most appropriately can be directed to the Department of Revenue, and I think Director Harchenko is here. You might want to ask her of those, as well as your legal counsel. You know, in the legal analysis that we got from the Attorney General's office and rebuttal, if you will, from various parties, that notion was challenged whether you could treat a gas company separate from other corporations in the state. So that's more of a legal argument that I think you want to explore that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Commissioner. And that is one of the issues we brought up. In fact, after our meeting this morning and met with Dexter, of course, who wrote this amendment, and we'll be happy to bring him in. I didn't ask him to come today just because of the workload that he has going, but he's available and felt clearly that he had no problem that you could differentiate a monopoly utility from other types of businesses, and even within that sector. And I don't want to paraphrase him, but we'll have Dexter come probably next week for any questions on that line. But in dealing with other utilities that have competitors who are unregulated, you know, it's totally different than those who have to flip a light switch and don't have that option. But those are good questions. But again, our legislative council feels totally comfortable in being able to differentiate that. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Byer, Commissioner Byer, share your pain and sickness today. So my question is, you indicated that this is a perception of fairness, but I think it's more than that. Isn't it also a more realistic picture of the tax obligations by doing it this way, the proposal that we have in the Dash Fours?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I think you're asking is the amount and rates, are they really paid? And the obvious answer to that is in some cases, no. But there's a difference between that and the tax laws which Congress and the legislature have passed in terms of you've allowed certain exemptions. There's I want to be real clear, we're not talking about anybody doing anything against the law. They're all complying with the tax codes that have been adopted. It's just it has different effects. you know, taxes and tax treatment and setting rates are very different. One of the things we talked about this morning, and I realize that you were not there, is one of the federal tests is if you're going to make the adjustment in the rate-making process, it has to bear relationship to something that, you know, is a benefit or a cost to the ratepayers. It's called the burdens and benefits test. And the example that we've talked about a lot is the Enron. You know, PGE as a utility encountered certain costs, and as an operating thing, as an operating entity, what they paid out was a correct reflection of the cost of operating the utility. The owner of that utility, Enron, when they got that money and were figuring their taxes with all of their other business, you know, costs and obligations and losses, the net result, and I think it's fairly clear on the surface, when you have a company that's bankrupt, it essentially means they ain't got no money. And so they had no taxable liability, and that, I think, is what upset people about that. But from the operating utilities perspective, the costs that were reflected in rates were reflected of the normal cost of operating the utility. That sounds like a whole bunch of mumble jumble, but, you know.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, mm-hmm. it was reflected in the rates, but the cost was, but then there were benefits that did not inure back to the ratepayers. The benefits went to the bankrupt company. Correct? I mean, they were able to spread the liability or the benefits through the whole larger company of Enron rather than just isolating those benefits to PGE.
Senator, I'm having a little trouble with your terminology. I understand what you're saying, but I'm a little trouble with your terminology. Yes, those, they were able to write off PGE's tax liability, in essence, because they had losses from other subsidiaries or other companies.
So the ratepayers of Oregon paid for that, which is what we're trying to get out here in the Dash 4, or with this whole bill.
Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with you.
We're two sick people trying to talk to each other. Thank you.
Any questions? Dexter, would you mind coming up forward? He was available, so I thought we might get some of those questions. Lee, just stand by. And
darn, I thought I was getting late.
A couple of things here I think would be helpful is I'd like to ask Mr. Warner if he would first go through the Dash 4 amendments as they relate to the testimony we just had from Commissioner Beyer, and then questions for Dexter regarding the ability to differentiate tax treatment for utilities, and any questions about the writing of the document. We also had a question, Dexter, about the definition for utility that was used in this particular amendment. So with that, Mr. Warner, if you could just walk us through the provisions of the amendment to the bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, on the Dash 4s, first of all, it's important to recognize that under our corporate income tax law, companies are required to file consolidated returns, and this doesn't change that. That remains the state policy on corporate income taxes, and there's good tax policy reasons for that we could talk about if you'd like, but that would remain the policy. So this is an exception to that policy in which essentially recommendation one from the PUC is contained in that section 3 of the amendment, which requires that any utility defined under ORS 314.610, which is fairly broad, as we mentioned, is required to even if they file a federal return, a consolidated return, they cannot file a consolidated return in Oregon. So what that means is, in terms of the mechanics and calculation of their state income tax, they would follow a method, and I believe the committee went through the white paper that the PUC provided, and they did give an example in that in terms of how in a standalone approach deconsolidated tax return would be calculated. So it would be fairly straightforward, and that would be the requirement. Now, I'm sure there's some methodological issues that would come up in terms of that calculation, but in theory it's pretty straightforward. Sub 2 under Section 3 does make allows a modification for these returns on the case for a separate return on behalf of an affiliated group that is limited to a corporation that is in the state primarily conducting energy-related activities. So a fairly narrow exception there, and that's obviously aimed at some existing operations now that would fit that definition. It begins to take effect in January 1, 2006, or tax year is beginning then. Remember, corporations file on a staggered basis, so they don't all start on January 1. They're pretty much spread across the months. So the first page there, Section 3, is really your Recommendation 1 from the Commission, which recommends that regulated utilities file standalone or deconsolidated income tax returns in Oregon. If you look on page 3 of Section 5, sub 6 there, this begins the process along with Section 6, which is really Recommendation 3 from the PUC, which requires regulated utilities to file a general rate case at least once every 5 years. So that's laid out. I think Commissioner Beyer explained that under current law that doesn't happen. There's a utilities can come forward and ask for a rate case, but some of them has gone as long as 10 years without having a general rate case.
Mr. Warner?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah. On this, I think they were trying to ask Commissioner Beyer how many entities would be under this section. Isn't this going to add to their expense? Their workload?
Senator Moss Anderson, I think really the discussion earlier was referring back to Section 3 in terms of the public utilities that are defined.
Okay. No.
And so the number of those that are defined could be more narrow than what's under 314.610, and this might be an area for Dexter to comment on, but this would be a fairly broad group. If you were to narrow it down to the definition under 757.005, that's the 26 companies that the commissioner referred to, and I think his answer was that it wouldn't require a large workload.
Dexter, would you want to, that might be a good point to interject here on the definition that we have in Section 3. The amendment does have the 314.
Right.
You want to comment on that? Commissioner Beyer and others were suggesting that the 757 statute was more limiting to what we were trying to get at, and just wanted to get your comments on that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. I agree that the 757 definition, if you're limiting it to energy utilities, is the more appropriate definition, and that was just a drafting error.
Go ahead, proceed.
Mr. Chair, I have that definition, and what it is, it's limited to aspects of furnishing heat, light, water, or power. So those are the four elements to it in that definition. Now, does that address your question, Senator?
Well, follow up. I'm just not aware of how much work goes into taking each corporation or entity and reviewing their schedule of rates. And if we're adding a big workload, I just was curious if that was going to be a ways and means issue.
Well, I can't speak directly to that, but I think it's pretty clear from the white paper as it was laid out by the commission that they go through and, in effect, calculate what a standalone state income tax would be in terms of their calculations. And they've laid that out in Attachment C of their February 1 white paper.
So, essentially, Senator, that... what this would do is have them file a non-consolidated tax return, and the commission sets the rates based on the non-consolidated tax return, so they would be synonymous. Go ahead.
Okay, the last element, three, is at the bottom of page 6 and the top of page 7. And again, this is linked directly to the third, actually was recommendation number 2 from the PUC, and that was to direct the commission to consider consolidated tax benefits when it includes federal income taxes and customer rates. And so if you look at the language there, starting on line 2, the commission may authorize the incorporation into rates of estimated federal and state taxes. And then it says that the commission shall take into account the effects of filing federal returns on a consolidated basis. So that's recommendation 2 is embedded in that portion of the amendment. And this is an issue that was discussed in the Revenue Committee this morning, and there would be some decisions there that the PUC would have to make in terms of actually implementing that particular provision.
Thank you, Mr. Warner. Mr. Johnson, if you could, we had a question prior to your arrival regarding the legitimacy of having a different tax requirement for the public utilities, the public energy utilities, as opposed to other corporations. And we'd be interested in your analysis on the ability to do that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, let me begin, I guess, with kind of a basic statement of what the law is, and that is that legislatures have generally broad latitude in creating different classifications for tax purposes, whereby if there is a rational basis for treating one group of taxpayers differently from another, courts will support that classification. Taking that analysis and applying that to this case, it's my conclusion that treating public utilities that are subject to a rate approval process with the PUC is in which taxes are taken into account, that is a sufficiently justifiable basis for treating those taxpayers differently from businesses that are not subject to that kind of rate regulation. And so that would be a permitted distinction between different groups of taxpayers.
If you could maybe narrow that further then to the differentiation between energy utilities and other utilities, and your analysis on that. Like, for example, of the wireless carriers or Verizon, Quest, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
The telecommunications.
Mr. Chair, that's a bit of a closer call, but I think even there's a distinction between telecommunications utilities, where they are also subject to competition with companies and new developing technologies that are not regulated, as contrasted with the energy utilities, where I think all competition there is between entities that are either public entities or subject to rate regulation.
Questions for Mr. Johnson? Paul, did you have a question, or do you want to introduce
me? It occurred to me, Mr. Chair, and Dexter may comment on this, but in an unrelated tax matter last session, you changed the apportionment formula, as you recall, on how we apportion corporate income for corporate entities that operate in more than one state, how we apportion them back to Oregon. And within that statute, there is a definition of telecom companies in which they are allowed an election to essentially to apportion their income under a different formula than what applies to other companies. So that strikes me as perhaps a similar kind of distinction.
I would agree with that.
Any other questions? Thank you for taking time. I know you're busy there. Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Okay. Let's see. Unless someone has actually signed up to testify, no one did. So I'm going to ask some people to come testify. You didn't sign up?
No, there wasn't a sign sheet.
Oh, well, come forward.
Good afternoon, Chairman Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Dan Meek. I wasn't expecting to be here. I didn't know about this hearing, actually, but I did see the...
Or on the web, you know. So
yes.
You could find it. We were posted.
Check it frequently, but I missed this one. In any event, I've had some involvement in this issue. I filed a complaint at the Public Utility Commission a little bit over 2 years ago against Portland General Electric for charging ratepayers income taxes, about $92.6 million a year, and then not actually paying those. The complaint was dismissed by the Public Utility Commission. In fact, I was gaveled into silence at the only public hearing about it by the chairman of the commission, Mr. Hemingway. So I appealed that to the Marion County Circuit Court, where Judge Dickey a few months later decided that the commission had erred in dismissing the complaint and sent it back to the commission, where it is where it's bumping along now. In the meantime, we've discovered other information about the utilities, that the fact that PGE has now charged us since 1997 $730 million for federal and state income taxes that it actually has not paid. And that amount increases by $254,000 per day. Every day, it's in our rates, $92.6 million a year. And it's not just Portland General Electric who's doing that. It's also Pacific Power and Light, and also perhaps other utilities as well. I found out just a few months ago that this is not only going on in a manner that the PUC has approved, but it's also going on the county level in a matter that the PUC has not approved. It is Portland General Electric actually puts a line on the bills for any customer in Multnomah County that says Multnomah County tax. And so I asked them in the proceeding how much you've collected in Multnomah, that's Multnomah County tax, that means the Multnomah County business income tax. I asked them how much have you collected in Multnomah County business income tax since 1997. They said, well, it's about $1.5 million a year, so it adds up to about something over $7 million right now. And then I asked them, how much have you paid Multnomah County in Multnomah County business income tax since 1997? And the answer was zero. That is, and that's not approved by, that's not even approved by the PUC. The PUC has a rule that says that a utility can tack on a line to the bill in any local jurisdiction if the local jurisdiction imposes upon the utility a tax that the utility is required to pay. That's what it says, required to pay. PGE concludes that it is entitled to charge me and other ratepayers in Multnomah County, the Multnomah County business income tax, on their income, even though they don't pay any of that to Multnomah County. So we have a lawsuit against Portland General Electric under ORS 756-185 for violating utility statutes, now pending in the Multnomah County Circuit Court. The ideas that the PUC have come up with, I think, miss one very important point, and that is none of them address the $730 million that PGE alone has charged us for income taxes they have not paid and will never pay. The first item of business, I would say, in any of this legislation is to get back that money. We should not close the barn door after 730 million horses have already left the barn and are wandering around. We need to get some of those horses, as many as possible, back in the barn door. So I would say that we need to change the baseline here, change the baseline for allowing these utilities to charge ratepayers for income taxes by saying that you don't get to charge ratepayers for income taxes even if you actually pay them until you've actually paid the income taxes you charged to ratepayers since for the last, let's say, 10 years, but didn't pay. So let's change the baseline. That is, they have to pay their income taxes that they've already charged to us before they can charge us more for income taxes. In addition, there's some problems with each of the ideas that the Public Utility Commission has advanced. The idea of filing a consolidated state tax return. The way the PUC calculates the income taxes that they allow utilities to charge to ratepayers is not based on any kind of hypothetical deconsolidated tax return. It's the most simple calculation you can possibly imagine. They take the projected net income of the utility and they multiply it by the effective tax rate, that is 34% federal, whatever it is on the state level, 6.5%, something like that. It's just a straight calculation. It assumes no deductions. It assumes no anything else. That's what gets charged to ratepayers. What the utility actually pays is much different. It's much different if they are consolidated, like with Enron or with Scottish Power. I know with Enron, the amount that Enron actually paid the state in income taxes since it took over PGE is zero. PGE did occasionally pay $10 a year when it was deconsolidated. But this problem also happens in standalone utilities or when utilities are not consolidated with their parents for calculation of federal or state income taxes. Portland General Electric was deconsolidated from Enron from the period of May 7th, 2001 through December 24th, 2002, about a year and a half. During that time, they charged ratepayers $140 million for federal and state income taxes, and they paid $10 to the state in 2002, and in 2003 they paid another $10. After charging us $15.6 million a year for the state income taxes that they weren't paying. We're paying it in our bills, but they're not remitting it to the state. So the notion, I'm uncomfortable with the notion of allowing of this hypothetical deconsolidated tax return being filed. And without examining the commission's report in greater detail, I wouldn't have any other comments at this time, but I would very much welcome any questions.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Meek. And I appreciate your observation of the $733 million. I think that might be a ball up a hill that may be very difficult to reach, particularly knowing that probably the ratepayers would end up paying that if that had to go out anyway. Although I appreciate exactly your point of view on that and understand that. I would be curious. I have because I know you have studied this stuff for a long time, and while there's been a lot of talk about PGE, which is what did certainly bring this thing forward, but as you're right and as the commissioner pointed out, this affects everyone. In your research, have you had any concrete evaluation of the other major utilities who would be subjected to this amendment, for example, Pacific Core through Scottish Power or Northwest Natural Gas? Have you any research in terms of the rates that they've been collecting and have actually paid, or is all your information limited to the PGE case?
Senator Metzger, Chairman Metzger, there are only so many hours in the day. I have not yet filed complaints against Pacific Power and Light or lawsuits against them to find out what that information is. Curiously, I found out in the various PGE proceedings that in the past, since Enron acquired PGE in 1997, neither the PUC nor the PUC staff has ever asked PGE how much income taxes they've paid, either on the federal level, the state level, or the county level. Never even ask them how much they paid. So I think the PUC ought to do a report. And the white paper I just heard mentioned was pitiful, really. I mean, it did not in any way describe the problem. It just said, well, here's what some other states do, and how it described what other states do was wrong. I filed two sets of comments on the white paper. In every circumstance in other states where they have, where they forbid utilities from charging ratepayers for income taxes they don't pay, it has always been upheld. That concept has been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court since 1956, and it's been upheld in the courts of every state that I've found. I can't find a case on Westlaw anywhere or in public utility reports where any kind of these adjustments have been disallowed. In any event, let's have the PUC ask the other utilities. How much have you charged ratepayers for income taxes? And let's go back 10, 20 years, whatever would be appropriate, on federal income taxes, state income taxes, local income taxes, and how much has actually been paid to each of those taxing jurisdictions, either by you or by your parent corporation on your behalf. Simple question, but the PUC has never asked it.
Thank you, Mr. Meek. Questions for Mr. Meek?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Deckert.
One comment, Mr. Meek, and I deeply appreciate the work that you've done. But in some ways, I feel like just in the way we characterize, I guess, the villains in this story, in many ways, I think, and I'll put myself at the center here as the revenue chairman in the state Senate, we're the ones who enact the tax laws. The companies conform to the tax laws that we enact. The PUC, it does not have jurisdiction, and so in some ways, I feel like if we're casting this issue, and rightfully so, we have it before us today, but if we look back over the last 5 or 10 years, we're the ones that are responsible for the tax laws of the state, and I've been at least a little, and I know where I know where I'm coming down on this issue, and I'm happy that folks have brought it up, but for me, I've just, I guess in the general dialogue on this, I've thought the story hasn't been accurately told of who really, because I don't blame the companies that much for just complying with the tax laws that we enact, and I apologize that it's more of a comment than a question, but I do feel it's important to at least set that correction in place.
Senator Becker, Chairman Metzger, I would say this is not a tax issue at all. It is a rate regulation issue. The state can tax utilities or other businesses as in any way that they wish. The entire point is not that the utilities are or are not complying with tax law. The point is that the Oregon Public Utility Commission allows them to charge the ratepayers $730 million of alleged costs that they never had. So I don't see this as a tax issue at all. I see it as a rate regulation issue.
So, Mr. Chair, your remedy, and this is helpful, your remedy would be that the PUC, that we would not go to a deconsolidated tax status for regulated monopoly utilities. Your remedy would be that the PUC, and when they do their rate setting, disallow any tax issue to be embedded in customers' rates. That would be the...
Senator Deckert, my first recommendation is that the baseline that we all start with is takes into account the amount that ratepayers have paid for utility income taxes that have never been paid over some period of time in the past. So essentially, you don't grant the utilities a bonus by closing the barn door after the horses are out. Secondly, there are any number of ways to go about this that other states and other public utility commissions in other states and the Federal Power Commission have adopted at various times. And I'm not ready at this point to give a recommendation on specifically how to do it. But in no event have I found cases where in these other states or other regulators where there's actually been a change in the tax law. It's simply a change in the way that utility rates are set to reflect real costs and not costs that are just essentially not there. And that's what these are. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court in its decision in 56 or 67 said that utility ratepayers have to pay for are required to pay for real costs. They're not required to pay for imaginary costs. And when you charge ratepayers for income taxes that are not paid, that's an imaginary cost. But I really don't think this requires a change in tax law. It requires a change in the law pertaining to the way rates are set.
So, Mr. Chair, my question would be, and very helpful, and I guess it's to Chairman Beyer, is that accurate? Could you, when setting rates, simply disallow, and this may take a... If you need to study it, I'm happy to wait. But could you simply just take out that portion, whatever it's 9% for individuals and whatever, you know, and try to figure in whatever big credits the state grants and say, we will discount that from the rates?
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, we do make some adjustments in the rate setting process. Mr. Meek has different views on that. The packet that I provided each of you have the filings of Mr. Meek in them and his positions, and they have others' response to them, including specific response from the Attorney General respecting Mr. Meek's position. I'm not an attorney. I'm not going to get into a disagreement. You can read those as well as I can. Suffice to say that the Attorney General does not agree with Mr. Meek.
Okay. And that's the document. I'm sorry, but that's the document I haven't seen.
Yeah. Thank you. Is there other questions for Mr. Meek? Okay, thank you very much. I think Mr. Meek's position and how it differs from the dashboard, I think a lot is that, if I could kind of capture what he's saying, he'd like to have the utilities have the ability to recapture in rates stuff that they have paid. In other words, we know they've paid it, now you can capture it. What the PUC has done in their recommendation, part of which is in the dashboard, is saying by having at least a five-year reevaluation, they can get to that same thing in a different way. It's a different approach and a different point of view of that. Is there anybody else who would wish to testify today on this?
Excuse me?
Yeah, I'm going to ask.
They're off the line.
Okay, then I will ask. Let's see, who should I bring up here? Kevin's in the back there? Yes. Sir, would you please come forward?
Lucky you.
See, this is what we call stealth sign-ups. We don't sign up, but we'll work other ways. But we just love to have the dialogue. So,
Chair Metzger, for the record, I'm Kevin Lynch with Pacific Corp, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Well, I think the first question, Mr. Lynch, would be, I know we've had discussions, I know you've discussed this with other members, and truly your insight is valued. So I would like for the record to give us your evaluation of the PUC's recommendations, which, as you know, are embodied in the Dash 4 amendments. May not be perfect yet, but that's the concept anyway.
Okay. I'll try. I haven't had much of a chance to read either their recommendations in detail or the Dash 4 amendments, but let me make a couple of observations that might be useful, I hope. There were a couple of comments that your colleague Senator Deckert made that I think are important to think about in framing this issue. One of them is where really is the responsibility for setting the kind of tax policy that ought to apply to utilities? And related to that, actually, is the second observation he made, which is what kind of animal is a utility or a company that owns a utility? They're both really good questions, and I want to explore them just a little bit with you to think about how this legislation really works or what it might mean. Utilities that are owned by investors or parent companies of utilities that are owned by investors have a number of obligations both to the customers and to the owners of the utility. One is to provide adequate and reliable service at reasonable rates for the utility service. The other is to try to make sure that investors are getting a good rate of return, and that's important to customers in a way too, because the ability of the utility to attract capital from investors is important as a utility needs to make investments to keep its system modern. So to some degree, yeah, we have some differences in the way that our products are priced and our service and our products are delivered, but we also have a lot of the same characteristics of any other business in this country to try to make our business attractive. The other thing I might observe too is that to the degree that you want to create a distinction between utilities that provide a service on a competitive basis or on a regulated basis, I might remind the committee that this legislature adopted retail electric competition for the two significant investor-owned electric utilities in Oregon in 1999. So we, in fact, do have competition. To some degree, it's a little bit more theoretical than it is practical right now, but that's a function of energy markets. It's not a function of state public policy. So it's worth considering that we have that additional burden on our business if we want to retain customers, that we in fact do have competition in some ways, some not all that dissimilar to some of the telecommunications companies. One of the ways that we try to make our business attractive to other to investors is by using some of our earnings and investing those in things that enhance our corporate parents' return. As you are aware, Pacific Corp has a number of affiliated businesses under a U.S. holding company, the most prominent of which, I guess, is here in Oregon, known as PPM Energy. PPM is the second largest developer and marketer of renewable energy or wind energy in the country. It has aspirations to become the largest. It is also a substantial developer and operator of something called natural gas storage, which essentially is a big warehouse underground for people who develop and transfer natural gas to various users. The warehouse service is provided so that supply and demand can be leveled and people can put in gas in underground when it's when demand isn't high, and take it out when it is. So that's a service that PPM is very involved in as a business. I want to focus for a minute on the renewable energy issue because it's an important one, and it's become a major focus of the company's business. We have about almost 900 megawatts of wind energy, either that PPM owns or owns the right to sell the power to. In 2000, I don't think PPM had any renewable energy, no wind energy. So that's a pretty big portfolio that's been built up in about 4 years. Aspirationally, they'd like to get to about 2,000 megawatts by the year 2010, and they have a business plan to get there. A key driver of the ability to run that business is the availability of a federal production tax credit for renewable energy. If PPM were a standalone business, the wind energy business is not profitable. It's standing, you know, on its own without that energy tax credit. So it needs a company, as does any renewable energy developer. It needs another company with a gain to be able to take advantage of those tax credits to offset, basically to offset their losses and to use the tax credit. So we think it's a good marriage of business and public policy to try to do those things together as affiliated businesses. There are a lot of other businesses that PacifiCorp has been involved in historically that have been involved with that have involved the use of various types of tax credits, be it for low-income housing or other real estate development. Right now, we're focused on energy, and that's where we want to be, and that's where I think we intend to stay for a while. But to the degree that that this legislative body and that the Congress and other state legislatures want to use the tax code to encourage the investment in socially and economically advantageous and desirable activities, I think you need to ask yourself a question. Why should or shouldn't the parent or an electric utility or a gas utility or the parent of one of those companies be not allowed or be disqualified from using its earnings to make those kinds of investments in the things that you want people to invest in? With that, I think I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. And I think you're aware what we attempt to do in Section 3.2a is to recognize PPM and other types of corporations within the state of Oregon involved with energy to allow a limited consolidation in recognition of those efforts. Questions for Mr. Lynch? Senator Starr.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Have you seen the language in Section 3.2a?
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, just quite recently. I haven't had the opportunity to parse it, and not being an attorney and certainly not being a tax attorney, I would need to have some expertise brought to bear on it.
Just an additional question.
Yes.
Approximately what kind of employment, how many folks does PPM employ in the state of Oregon? And, you know, if you know, this language in 2A isn't appropriate, I don't know. What I just want to tread lightly here. If we're putting Oregonians that are working here, those jobs,
sure,
in jeopardy, perhaps.
Fundamentally, there are two. PPM has about 200 employees in the Portland area, out of a company of about 300. They are engaged in a number of different types of businesses effective around the country, the development and marketing of renewable energy projects that PPM has developed are in Oregon, Washington, Wyoming, Colorado, California, Iowa, Minnesota, and there are developments that are underway in a number of other states. Most of the development and marketing work for those activities are headquartered in Portland. And it's similarly with energy trading off of those renewable projects. The trading floor, the primary trading floor for the company is in Portland as well. That's about 200 employees. I might add that 5 years ago, I think PPM had 5 employees. So it's as I mentioned, there were no wind projects in the portfolio 4.5 years ago. Now there are almost 1,000 megawatts.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Lynch. And I think that's a very good point, Senator Starr, which is why we actually included that in there, so that the intent being that if, of course, keeping in mind that on a federal basis, wherever they are, they can still receive whatever benefit of the consolidated one. But in the state of Oregon, if they are involved with other subsidiaries, such as PPM, and doing good things in the energy field to allow them to offset the profits, say, in this case of a PacifiCorp for that activity, we think we should make sure that that is part of the package. And I think that is important, not to take away that incentive for renewables. For the last person I will ask to come up this afternoon is Elizabeth Harchenko, please. And then we will conclude this for the day. Move on to the other items. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
I think what we would like, and some members may have some specific questions, but I would think what I would prefer to start with anyway is your overview of the from a revenue side for the recommendations by the Public Utility Commission and what the committee is addressing here with the dash fours or something similar to them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. I am going to keep my comments very general. We've only just begun to look at these amendments. We've already identified an issue that was discussed earlier with Mr. Johnson, and that there are some technical questions if you decide to pursue this policy of requiring a separate company filing or a separate group of companies to file together that aren't part of a consolidated federal return. There's probably a little more language that we would need than what's in the bill right now, and we'll be happy to work with staff on that. This conversation has been going on, as you mentioned earlier, for a couple of years now, and I think what I'd like to focus on is the fundamental policy the legislature adopted in going with the consolidated federal return as the primary base in the first instance for any corporation that's filing under our corporate tax laws. Of course, consistency with federal returns is a value that we've talked about in both the individual income tax and the corporate income tax. And in Oregon, the statutes track fairly closely with the definitions of taxable income and, for corporate purposes, which companies are in the group that the state looks to determine how much tax is attributable to the activities that group conducts within the state. And there are years in which using that methodology of saying we're going to look at an economic enterprise and determine what the liability of the those companies in that enterprise who are present and doing business in our state, what their liability is with respect to the activity of the entire enterprise. In some years, that means that Oregon would get more income tax, more corporate tax, from the company that's actually here physically than it would get on a standalone basis, and in other years, less. The kinds of concerns that you would hear from on the tax policy side would be when you separate out a legal entity from a group that's conducting a single kind of business, a single business enterprise, but is using multiple business entities, the risk is created that in the pricing of transactions that occur between members of that family, that income can be moved from where it's earned to somewhere else. And we're actually seeing a lot of conversation about this on the federal level right now with respect to domestic versus foreign corporations that are really owned and are part of the same kind of business, where transactions such as loans, payments for the use of patented process or trademarks are the vehicles by which income is moved somewhere where it's not within anybody's taxing jurisdiction. So I would just alert you that whenever you go to separate company accounting, you do create that risk if the kind of business that the company is engaged in has that possibility. So you would, I think you would want to think about that. The other thing is that, again, as we just looked at the amendments, it seems to be clear in the report, the recommendation, and the conversation among committee members that the focus of the amendments is intended to be only regulated utilities. The way the amendments are written right now, they are broader than just regulated utilities. So we would be happy to participate in making sure that, the language does that. Otherwise, we administer whatever tax law you tell us you want administered. We do have provisions in our statutes today that do allow the department on audit to review the reports that are the returns that come in and try to determine whether they fairly reflect the income earned through activities engaged in Oregon. And there is always the possibility that on audit, especially of a separately filed return, we might take the position that something that's going on in that return or separately from that return that affects the tax liability of the company isn't correct and assess additional tax. And that can happen as much as 3 or 5 or 7 years later, depending upon whether there's a federal audit that reopens those same years. So it's just there are some technical aspects of how the tax law works and how our administration works that I would want you to be informed about as you make the decision.
Well, thank you, Mr. Shevchenko. The you know, there's a couple of things, and you heard the testimony here earlier, and going back to when we had this discussion a couple of years ago before the Senate Revenue Committee that Senator Decker was chairing at that time, that important to look at the distinction between general corporations and utility monopolies would provide essential services, which, unlike if we have Star Metzger Enterprises, we may make money or lose money based on our business model, but in a regulated utility where a rate of return of profit on return on equity is dictated by the Public Utility Commission, mm-hmm. as opposed to someone else who is making their own risks and then being allowed to assess ratepayers for that. Your points are very, very valid on looking at especially technical aspects of the bill. We will definitely work with your department to make sure that that is correct.
Mm-hmm.
Questions from the committee?
Yes.
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, what does this change mean to your department as far as your staffing levels, your ability to administer this kind of change? Is it, I mean, what, talk a little bit about what that would mean.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, if the scope of the bill is limited, as the discussion indicates, to a fairly small number of taxpayers, I don't think it's going to have an appreciable impact in terms of it's not going to require us to get additional staff. We might need to do some specialized training. We might need to do some rulemaking to help be as predictable as possible to those companies that would be using this method if it's approved. But I don't see a significant change in the way that we do our work. As we would audit a company that was subject to this rule, we would audit according to the terms of the statute.
Other questions? Thank you, Mrs. Harchuk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Colleagues, my objective would be to work with staff on making the corrections and to the bill that are necessary, first of all, to limit it to the scope of which we have discussed. Secondly, to work with the Department of Revenue on any issues they have to make sure that is correct. One thing I'll say, I did say about a month ago, and I'll say it one more time, Mr. Meek brought this point up in terms of the hypothetical issue of collecting taxes and the possibility that profits could be such that that you would actually have to collect more from ratepayers because you were too profitable, as opposed to being able to determine what you were allowed in rates and then what you actually end up paying to the state. And we don't know the numbers on some of the other firms. We do know from Portland General Electric because of the activities. We don't know for PP&L. We don't know for Northwest Natural. But again, what I would say prior to going to work session on the bill, perhaps next week or shortly thereafter, would be I will make an offer once again if any of the utilities that would be subject to regulation under this bill care to share evidence that they had to pay more than they actually collected at any time in the last 10 years. So we're talking about dozens and dozens of tax years. I would be happy to consider that information to see that you actually had to pay more than you were allowed to collect before we went move forward with the bill. So far, no single tax year has been presented to me that that took place. So, but I'll ask that one more time and would be happy to have the committee consider that. Other than that, we will work on that and bring this bill back at that time, and we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 171. And thank you for your attendance on that, and thank you, Mr. Warner, for helping us on that. Let's see. Let's go. Senator Walker, are you prepared to do the 323?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Since you're here, let's go ahead. I know you're not feeling well. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 323. Senator Walker, if you want to go down and present this or from up here, whatever you want to prefer to do. This is the independent contractor bill that we heard earlier. And that's your choice, but since you're here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have anything to present myself other than the parties who are going to come forward and explain what we're going to do. It's my understanding that we have not reached agreement on the amendments, and the bill will be presented as it was originally presented to the committee. And I think Ms. Harshenko and any other parties might want to come up and address that.
Okay. Ms. Harshenko, would you please come forward? I even have somebody signed up for and against the bill, the same person. That'll be really interesting. welcome again.
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chair. For the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. As the committee members will recall, at the hearing on this bill, at the end of February, there were two sets of amendments that were presented. The Dash 1 amendments would have brought the workers' compensation program a little more tightly connected into Senate Bill 323. The issue that that was, I think, being attempted to be addressed was the ability for the workers' comp program to use the definition of independent contractor in the bill to actually determine whether someone was a worker. Several people who testified at that hearing raised questions about both the efficacy of that and whether there were some unintended consequences that might be a result of the way in which the language was drafted. And a group of several people who know a whole lot about workers' comp got together and worked through this and came to the conclusion that you can't get there from here on workers' comp without creating some unintended consequences and disrupting settled expectations about how the workers' compensation statutes work. And so the top goal being we do need the bill. The group that worked on this is and the workers' comp division of DCBS is withdrawing those amendments, and I think I'm okay to speak for them on that issue. We had another of other questions that came up during the hearing. I had written a memorandum with Lisa Trussell on March 16th, which I believe was distributed, shared with committee members very shortly thereafter. We had a question from the Farm Bureau concerning how the bill would apply to custom farmers, and we conferred with Mr. Schellenberg, and I think he's satisfied that the way that the bill works is the way that the test used to work for custom farmers, and he's all right. We had another question raised about whether the presumptions under the workers' compensation statutes about licensed contractors would remain in place and effect, and I think we've satisfied the Building Industry Association that in fact is the case. The third issue was around the Dash 1s, and because it was pretty clear that there were more problems created than solved by the Dash 1s, the recommendation is that those be withdrawn. Today, two additional issues have arisen. Senator Walker, are you okay with me presenting those?
Please.
The Dash 2 amendments that were presented at the end of February were offered with the intention of assisting the courts in understanding how the legislature wanted this bill to fit into the work that the courts have already done in interpreting prior versions of ORS 670600. We've had some concern expressed by folks who participated in the task force during the interim that this might create more confusion than clarity, and there is other language in the bill that talks about the importance of consistency in administration by the agencies, and so we're recommending that now that those dash two amendments can be set aside, and if there is a need for more in the way of a legislative finding statement, we'll work on that as the bill moves its way to the House. I also understand, and you may want to call Mr. Gallagher up.
I will.
That there were some dash three amendments, and I think the same solution is most appropriate for this committee to be able to act on the bill is for his concerns to be worked on with folks from the task force and with Senator Walker and Representative Brown, and to the extent a solution is needed to present that on the House side. So at this point, I think the group is back with recommending that the committee report out Senate Bill 323 without any amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gallagher, you had some issues, I think, brought up with the newspaper stringers and there are others that could fit that.
Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. I concur with the way Ms. Ovchenko laid this out, and we would be happy to try to work them out if anything needs to be worked out on the House side so that you can proceed with the bill.
And I think, just for the record, Mr. Gallagher had a concern for people who are stringers. Stringers are people who may write a story for the Oregonian, for example, who live in Newport, and rather than send a reporter over, they'll hire somebody just to write a story on occasion or submit a story. Photographers also are in that category. And the way this was written, it was unclear as to what they would be. I also pointed out to Mr. Gallagher, when he brought that point up, that people in my profession in public relations, there are people who are individuals who work at home and do that type of stuff on a piecemeal basis, very similar, that would have a question. And my understanding is, Ms. Harchenko, that you think there are some ways through the rulemaking process that you'd have the authority to deal with some of those issues.
Mr. Chair, I think that there are three things that need to happen. The first is we do need to confer about the specific issue that Mr. Gallagher has raised, which is someone who does something, receives compensation for doing that, but what they're doing is something that's fairly well defined and in a very, very limited type of activity and relationship. I believed when we conferred a few weeks ago that that the agencies, as we work together to do joint rulemaking and joint guidelines for industry-based guidelines for the application of the bill, might be able to address that in that process. The concern has come up whether that's true from one of the other agencies, and so what we would like to do is continue to work on it while the bill moves over to the other House, and if there is something that needs to be added, propose it at that time, and if after some thought it appears that we are able to do something just in the administrative process, then figure out what that is so that we're not trying to decide in a very, very compressed time frame.
Okay. But I just to emphasize again for the record, but you do, I take it, understand or have a recognition that there may be some issues with that are not an easy fit under the way the bill is right now for certain individuals.
Mr. Chair, I do. I've had quite a conversation with Mr. Gallagher about the factual situations that he's concerned about, and it appears that there are some things that don't fit nicely in employee or independent contractor. There may be just a little gap here, and we need to think about what's the most appropriate medium by which to address it.
Okay, thank you. Questions for any of these folks? Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for not making me step around. The less energy I expend, the better. I just wanted to state that if we don't pass this bill, we already have operative legislation that will stay in statute. So, and that was the deal. There was a lot of work put into this. This has just come down to a couple of tiny little things. In some people's minds, it's pretty large, but in others, they're very small. I generally do not like sending material over over to the other side of the building unless it's ready. I think this is ready enough, and that my colleague, Representative Brown, who also served on this task force, should have the opportunity to review this bill in detail and work out any minor details that might be there. So, Mr. Chair, my advice would be that the bill would be ready to move.
Okay. Thanks, Senator Walker. Any questions? Thank you very much. We have one other testimony before we move. John Dranius, Oregon State Bar. Is it P or D?
D.
It's a D. Okay.
D.
I couldn't tell.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to speak in opposition to the Dash 2 amendments, which have been withdrawn.
I'm even saying a word. Look at the impact.
Don't need to do that, I suppose. And I would speak very briefly in favor of the bill itself. I represent the tax section of the Oregon State Bar, and 2 years ago we were the ones who introduced the bill that was ultimately passed and led to the creation of the task force. I've been involved in the task force and this task force very, very heavily all through last year. Everybody worked really hard. Everybody had different viewpoints. Everybody put a lot of effort into this. We've gained a lot of respect for each other and everybody's positions. This bill that comes from the report of the task force is the best compromise that we were able to come up with. It's a very acceptable compromise to my group, and I urge the committee to vote this bill on, and it makes good law. It improves on what we have. It'll be an improvement over what would be the law if nothing happened, and it would be my recommendation that the committee pass this favorably and move it to the other side.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very, very much. Well, with that, what I'm going to do is close the public hearing on Senate Bill 323. Open a work session on Senate Bill 323, and before us, members, is the bill. We have some amendments, and I believe it is the desire of the task force and would be of the chair to ignore the amendments at this point and pass the bill as is.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 323 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Can I guess that Senator Walker would like to carry the bill?
Oh, sure. Thank you.
All righty. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 323 and open a public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 2. Floyd Lenter and Cheryl Pellegrini, if you would want to come forward. Don't take it personal that everybody's leaving the room as you've stepped forward. You get used to it after a while. Welcome.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Walker.
Could I just introduce this bill and then scoot
please.
Off to my other committee?
Your name's on this one, too?
Yeah,
okay,
that's fine.
Okay, well, go right ahead, then.
I have too many bills. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say this bill is about states' rights and protecting states' rights, and I'll let the certified smart people discuss why that's important.
Okay, thank you, Senator Walker.
Thank you for allowing me to sit in.
Welcome.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter. I serve as the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I appear here today to request the committee support for Senate Joint Memorial Number 2. The measure before you expresses the continuing concern of state legislators, governors, attorney generals, and banking regulators over state laws preempted by regulations adopted by the Office of the Comptroller of Currency in January 2004. Under those regulations, national banks and any operating subsidiaries of a national bank are regulated only by that federal agency, the Comptroller of the Currency. Businesses that fit the definition of operating subsidiaries include mortgage lenders, consumer finance companies, and money transmitters. In addition to state consumer protection laws, the regulations preempt state licensing and requirements to meet qualifications to engage in these businesses. There are no comparable federal laws requiring persons operating these businesses be experienced or knowledgeable, be denied a license based on criminal background, or file surety bonds or similar proof of financial investments that may be accessed by harmed consumers to make them whole, as what currently exists in programs administered by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Under the federal regulations, any Oregon consumer complaints must be forwarded to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, to their Consumer Assurance Center in Houston, Texas. The ability of this state, through this department and the Attorney General, to protect individual Oregon consumers is compromised by this preemption. I would also add that the department and the Attorney General continue to work closely at the state level on these preemption issues, and I've included copies of department correspondence with our Oregon congressional delegation and to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency with comments on the preemption issue itself. Respectfully request that the committee support the measure and send it to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, and I thank you for allowing me to provide testimony on this matter.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Leonard. Ms. Pellegrini?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the Oregon Department of Justice, serving as the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. I appear today on behalf of Attorney General Myers in support of Joint Memorial No. 2. This memorial echoes the position that has been taken by all 50 states and is embodied in written testimony, which is I've just presented. It's a October 6, 2004 letter by all the state attorneys general to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. The position of the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency represents a significant departure from the dual system that's been in place for over 130 years. And that system, has provided that national banks are subject to state law unless a state law significantly impairs the national bank's powers created under federal law. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency has, by virtue of two rules that were made final in January of 2004, essentially taken the position that it and it alone it has the authority to enforce any law that is to be enforced against a state bank or its operating subsidiary, non-bank operating subsidiary. This position, as Mr. Lantner noted, extends to state attorney generals as well, because the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency has asserted that it has the exclusive authority to enforce state consumer protection laws against national banks, even where those laws have nothing to do with ensuring the safety and soundness of banking institutions. The letter that I provided notes two significant areas as examples. One, the enforcement of state no-call laws by states against national banks, and two, the enforcement of state consumer protection telemarketing laws against vendors hired by national banks, where those vendors then, as agents of the banks, commit unlawful and deceptive acts or practices. Members of Congress have raised questions and doubts about the OCC's position and have recognized the role of the states, and that we urge you to lend your voice as well to our congressional delegation, and we would urge you to move this bill to the floor, or memorial to the floor, with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions from Senator Montes Anderson? Okay. Thank you very much. For the moment, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill or Senate Joint Memorial 2. And let's see, we have one more on our docket. That's a work session, which I will open on Senate Bill 10,002. And, Dana, if you want to come forward in...
1,002.
Huh? 1,002. Well, I guess I was thinking it was the House bill or something, you know, 10,000 or whatever they got over there. Welcome again.
Thank you.
Why don't you walk us through the modifications that we have come up with here?
Chair Metzger, I don't have my paperwork in front of me, but...
Okay.
The request was to have language on the bottom of the bill that we have eliminated, and we so did that, and back to the original language, which to satisfy the CCB. Craig was interested in that when we were here prior.
So that is in the dash 2, is that what we're dealing with here?
Yes.
The dash two amendment. So just so I make this correct here, on page 3, line 26, restore will not void the contract.
Correct. And then okay. Get rid of what was put in there.
And then makes the contract voidable by the consumer, because that was the concern that was articulated in the hearing on that.
Correct.
Okay. That's pretty simple. Senator Mossman, do you have any questions?
No.
Okay.
I'm ready for it, but we can't do anything.
Well, then we will. I'm going to recess. I mean, we'll be at Eddie's just for a few seconds so I can kind of update Senator Starr here.
1002.
Senator Starr has moved the dash two amendment to 1002. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Okay, Mr. Chair, I will move Senate Bill 1002 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr's move Senate Bill 1002 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Have we had any testimony before this committee on this particular bill from the construction industry folks, whether the Oregon Building Industry Association, the Remodelers Association?
I know they're aware of it, but no, they have not.
Okay.
Any other discussion? Any objection? All right. So ordered. You can't carry the bill, so I don't know. We'll ask Senator Schrader to carry the bill.
Oh, my.
Because that way you'll have to vote yes for you, which will be a... Okay, now I'm going to reopen the work session on Senate Joint Memorial 2. Senator Atkinson.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
We just had testimony on this. Did you have any questions about it at all, the memorial?
Thank you, no.
Okay. So we're in work session on Senate Joint Memorial 2, as written.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move SJM 2 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Joint Memorial 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. We'll ask Senator Walker to carry. Thank you very much, everyone. We're adjourned.